Damar Hamlin plays safety for the Buffalo Bills of the National Football League. You might have heard his name in the news this week. On Monday night, the Bills were playing the Cincinnati Bengals. And at one point in the game, Damar Hamlin collapsed on the field. He went into cardiac arrest, this 24-year-old athlete. And of course, the medical teams rushed onto the field, and believe it or not, they performed CPR on his heart to restart his heart. We later learned not just once did they do that, but twice. They had to do it a second time as they rushed him to the University of Cincinnati Medical Center Hospital. And of course, this stunned fans and players alike. And we've been watching this unfold, paying attention to his status. For days, he's been in the ICU under critical condition. Even more impressive than the response of the medical professionals, and that was impressive enough, but what was even more impressive was the response of the fans and the players. Everybody started praying, including both teams. They encircled Damar Hamlin, and they dropped to one knee. And everybody started praying. Realizing the seriousness of the injury, some of the players began sobbing and then did the one thing and the only thing that their desperate heart knew to do in that moment, and that was to pray. To pray. You know, prayer at its basicness is communication with God. But in another sense, prayer is our declaration of dependence upon God. Let me say that again. Prayer is a declaration of dependence on God. When all else fails, we pray, right? However, prayer should be our first impulse, not the last, but last resort praying works too. Even atheists pray in the foxhole, especially when the bullets are flying over their head. And when Damar Hamlin, this 24-year-old athlete, lay on the field this week, players and fans and even some sports analysts embraced the power of prayer. They embraced the power of prayer at a time when some people in our culture and some people in the sports world are trying to silence prayer. No, we can't do that. We can't do that. I'm thinking of one high school coach who lost his job about a year ago because he led his players in prayer. Thankfully, the Supreme Court of the United States said, no, you can't do that. Religious freedom, reinstated his job. But somebody said this week, just like that, the NFL said, prayer is okay on the field. Just like that. It took the cardiac arrest of one of the players right on national television to alert us once again to our need for prayer and the power of prayer. The last time I counted, I have 38 books in my personal and pastoral library on the subject of prayer. That doesn't mean I'm an expert on prayer, far from it. What it means is there are a lot of books published on the subject of prayer, and I can't resist buying them. I just keep buying them and buying them and buying them, much to the chagrin of my wife, who sees the books piling up in different places in my home and in my office. One of the most recent books that I bought on prayer was written by Tim Keller, the pastor and New York Times bestselling author. In his book, Prayer, Experiencing Awe and Intimacy with God, Tim Keller says, prayer is one of the most common phenomena of life. He goes on to say, in the great monotheistic religions of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, prayer is at the heart of what it means to believe. Muslims are called to pray 5 times a day, while Jews have traditionally prayed 3 times a day. Each branch of the Christian church is saturated with various traditions of common prayer, private prayer, and pastoral prayer. Prayer is not limited to monotheistic religions, he says. Buddhists use prayer wheels. Hindus may pray for help and peace in the world to any of several gods, even hundreds of gods in Hinduism. People in other cultures, such as the Beaver Indians of Southwest Canada and the Papago Indians of the U.S. Southwest, pray through singing. He says their poetry and music serve as prayers that unite the spiritual and physical realms. Well, prayer, as Keller says, might be one of the most common phenomena of life, but you look a little bit closer and it may not be common enough in most of our churches. According to an article written and published in USA Today, Souder Manufacturing, which is the largest American-based manufacturer of church pews, Souder Manufacturing says that 80% of church pews that are ordered do not have the prayer kneeler. Now, what does that say about the place and priority of prayer in our churches today? Generations ago, you would go to church, you would sit in a pew, and there was a kneeler there. Why? Because we knelt in prayer in church. Where has that gone? I'm asking us as a congregation, I'm asking us as a pastoral staff, where is the place and the priority of prayer in our churches today? As Christians, we often talk about prayer as one of the most important spiritual disciplines if we're serious followers of Jesus Christ, and that is certainly true. But effective prayer is born of passion, not of habit. If it's just a discipline, if it's just a habit, it becomes rote, it becomes boring, it becomes, well, we end up down the road in a prayerlessness state, not only as a church, but also as individual believers. E.M. Bounds was a well-known preacher and a man of prayer from a previous generation, and he had this in mind when he said, prayer ought to enter into the spiritual habits, but it ceases to be prayer when it is carried on by habit only. Desire gives fervor to prayer. He says the soul cannot be listless when some great desire fixes and inflames it. Strong desires make strong prayers. He goes on to say the neglect of prayer, listen to this, the neglect of prayer is the fearful token of dead spiritual desires. The soul has turned away from God when desire after him no longer presses it into the closet. And there can be no true prayer without desire, passion, fervency, the kind of earnestness in prayer that we see illustrated, well, in a man named Elijah in the Old Testament. When passion boils over into prayer, God hears the prayers of his people and he goes to work. And this was true in the life of Elijah, who prayed fervently. And according to James in the New Testament, Elijah's prayers got results. James chapter 5, verses 17 and 18, James says, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed fervently that it might not rain. And for 3 years and 6 months, it did not rain on the earth. Then he prayed again, and heaven gave rain, and the earth bore its fruit. These days, I read these verses from James with a little bit of a smile on my face, and I think of all the climate activists. We're protesting here and legislating there. Did they ever consider prayer to change the climate? That's all Elijah did. Elijah prayed and he changed and influenced the weather forecast of all things. Of course, James is not trying to make a climate change point, and Elijah wasn't either. But Elijah prayed with red hot fervency. There was earnestness, there was desire, there was passion in his praying. Now, we might be tempted to kind of write this off as, well, Elijah was one of those super saints in the Bible. And we might be tempted to do that to excuse our own prayerlessness. You know, I'm not Elijah, I'm just, you know, I'll get into heaven just on by the skin of my teeth here and by the grace of God, but I'm not an Elijah. James doesn't let us do that. James says that Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. In other words, Elijah the prophet was an ordinary man through whom God did extraordinary things. And Elijah was that ordinary man whose passions were inflamed by God's agenda and nothing else. Where are the Elijahs today? May we all become stricken with this passion and this fervency and this earnestness in our prayer life. Aristotle was a philosopher. He wasn't a clergyman. And Aristotle, as a Greek philosopher, was not so concerned about prayer as he was persuasion. He taught his students how speakers persuade their audiences. I remember learning about this when I was in seminary in my preaching classes, and even earlier than that speaking classes that I took in college. Aristotle said that persuading an audience is kind of like a three-legged stool. It takes three things. It takes logos, ethos, and pathos. Those are Greek words. Logos refers to the speaker's words and his content. Ethos refers to his ethic or his character. So you've got logos, the words, flowing through somebody who is a person of ethics and character. In other words, he lives out or tries to live out the best he can what he is saying. But he says that's not enough. The third leg in that three-legged stool after logos and ethos is pathos, and that's passion. You take any one of those three legs out, and Aristotle says you won't persuade your audience as well. Imagine a speaker with passion, but he really didn't have much to say, didn't have content, didn't have words, you know, that have meaning to them. Or his life is not in order, and ethics make it crumble. Or he has great content, great words, even an ethical life through which it flows, but there's no passion. Where's the passion? Well, what's true in persuading people is also true in prayer. The right words alone are not enough to engage the heart of God, logos. Even if those words flow through an ethical life, ethos, God wants to hear and to feel the passion in our soul as we knock on heaven's door and say, God, there's a 24-year-old athlete here who's in cardiac arrest. You can just feel the passion in that moment on the NFL field. It even came through an ESPN analyst named Dan Orlovsky. Did you hear about this? He just stopped in the middle of an NFL live broadcast and said, I just feel led to pray. He bowed his head, closed his eyes, and led the television audience in prayer on behalf of Damar Hamlin. Who does that? That's passion, desperation bubbling up inside a human heart. Now, nobody displayed a greater passion for prayer than Jesus of Nazareth. The four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, show us how prayer was a vital aspect of the Savior's life and ministry. And in your notes, I bullet pointed some of the different times and places that Jesus prayed. It's just all throughout the Gospels. For example, Jesus prayed early in the morning. I love the little glimpse that Mark chapter 1 and verse 35 gives us. It says very simply that Jesus got up early in the morning and went away to a lonely place and he prayed. Yeah, before his day started, before the crowds started pressing in on him, before his cell phone began ringing and pinging and grabbing his attention, he went off to a place where nobody could bother him, and he prayed. An indication even Jesus knew, I can't start my day answering all that's getting thrown at me throughout the day until I first have a conversation with my Father in heaven. He prayed while under stress. The Garden of Gethsemane, do you remember that? When stress was so powerfully flowing through his human body, one of the gospel writers said he sweat drops of blood. That's a medical condition known as hematidrosis, that when stress comes upon the body, the capillaries just under the skin begin to break down and it mixes in with your sweat and you're sweating drops of blood. He prayed during his baptism. He prayed before eating, before taking a meal. In John 17, he prayed for his disciples. We're going to be studying the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. It's called the Lord's Prayer. We call it that. It's really a model prayer. Some people like to call John 17 the real Lord's Prayer. It's really the high priestly prayer of Jesus. If you want to ascend prayer mountain and hear Jesus pray for you and for the disciples in all the ages, read John chapter 17. He prayed when he was alone and with his disciples. He prayed before a major decision in his ministry. That major decision being the time he chose his disciples, chose his leadership, the leadership he would train for 3 years to carry on the gospel to the ends of the earth. The Bible says Jesus prayed all night long. Father, is it Peter? Hey, what about this guy named Bartholomew over here? Lord, I think James and John, would you confirm that? He prayed for his disciples before he actually chose them. And then he prayed when he was weary on a mountaintop. And of course, I've already alluded to it, Jesus taught his disciples how to pray. They came to him one day and said, Lord, teach us to pray. They didn't say, teach us to teach, even though he was a master teacher. They didn't say, teach us to do that miracle thing you do. That would really be cool if we could do that too. Now, there was something about his prayer life that caught their attention and that highlighted something that was missing in their own communication with the Father. And they said, Lord, would you teach us how to pray? I remember when I was in seminary, working on my master's degree in theology, I almost majored in professors. A seminary I attended had some rock star theological professors. They were the ones writing all the books and influencing my heart and many others. One of those professors was Dr. Howard Hendricks. I took every course Dr. Hendricks taught. I took all the required courses, and I looked up in the catalog all of the electives I could take. I majored in Dr. Hendricks. I remember one of his classes, and it's pretty much true in all of his classes, you always got there right on time, if not early, because Dr. Hendricks would start the class this way. For the next hour, here's your assignment. He wouldn't write it on the board. It wasn't in the syllabus. You had to be there at the start of class, because he was going to say it once, and he made clear at the beginning of the semester, don't come up to me after class and say, oh, Prof, I couldn't get there on time. Could you tell me what the assignment is? Go talk to one of your classmates, he would say. So you'd get there early. For the next hour, here's the assignment. Have it turned in next time. You'd write it down. But as time went on, I also learned I wanted to be there because the next thing Prof would do is he would pray. He would pray for our class time. And what I appreciated about Prof's praying for us was it came across not in a showmanship way. That wasn't Prof at all. But what we heard was a man who had previously been spending time in the presence of God. And the way he communicated and had conversation with the Father on behalf of his students in our class time, I wanted some of that. How do you get there? I think that's kind of what the disciples had sensed with Jesus. They had picked up on his prayer habits. They had heard him pray for them and others, and they had gone looking for him at that time early in the morning. Where's Jesus? The crowds are coming. We're interrupting his prayer life. And they came to him and said, Lord, would you teach us how to do that? We're going to explore that prayer throughout this series in detail. What did he teach them? In the meantime, the writer of Hebrews offers some further insight into Jesus' prayer life by saying this in Hebrews 5 and verse 7. In the days of his flesh, Jesus offered up prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his reverence. The writer of Hebrews might have Gethsemane in mind, but maybe, too, the disciples heard him praying. Loud cries and tears. Oh, the passion that flowed through our Savior's heart. All four of the gospel writers record another time that gives us a little insight into the passion by which Jesus prayed and the passion he had for prayer. I want us to go to Mark chapter 11. I want to read verses 15 through 18. And before I read it, my hope and my prayer is that you will come away with the same sense that I did, is that there's a really good reason why all four of the gospel writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, remembered this scene, wrote it down in their memoirs. And it's here for us in the Gospels. Mark 11, beginning in verse 15. And they came to Jerusalem. And Jesus entered the temple and began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers?" And the chief priests and the scribes heard it and were seeking a way to destroy him, for they feared him, because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. Just take a deep breath. Let that sink in a little bit. Now, that scene will actually leave you breathless. An angry, red-faced Jesus ransacking the temple. I mean, it's a bit unsettling, isn't it? Especially if you still have Sunday school images of Jesus hugging the little children, frolicking in the fields with the lambs. You have room in your theology and your understanding of him to picture a Jesus that expresses righteous anger, turning over the tables. John tells us, cracking a whip, saying, "You've turned this into something that my Father never meant it to be. Stop." There's something about this scene that doesn't align with the airbrushed images that we have of Jesus 2,000 years later. And when Jesus said, "My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations," he was quoting from Isaiah 56 and verse 7. They should have known this. This was in the Old Testament scriptures. "These I will bring to my holy mountain," it says, "and make them joyful in my house of prayer. For their burnt offerings and their sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the peoples." Centuries earlier, this prayer came through the ministry of the prophet Isaiah. And this envisioned all the nations, not just Israel, but all the nations, all the ethnicities, coming to the house of God for one purpose: to worship him and to pray. And here they were in the first century and they didn't get it. They turned it into something the Father never meant it to be. Now, a careful reading of all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, leads us to believe that Jesus cleansed the temple, not once, but twice in his ministry. Matthew, Mark, and Luke put this story at the end of their gospel during Holy Week, the final week of Jesus' life, just days leading up to his crucifixion. But John, in his gospel, places it at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Some skeptics will say, "Well, there you go, the Bible contradicts itself." No, read the accounts carefully. There's enough difference in the detail to suggest he did this twice, not once. In fact, John, in his gospel, is the one that mentions the whip of cords. Jesus cracking the whip as he goes through the temple, overturning the tables of the money changers. Let's read John's account in John chapter 2, verses 13 through 17. "The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons and the money changers sitting there. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, 'Take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of trade.' And his disciples," this is great, "his disciples remembered that it was written, 'Zeal for your house will consume me.'" Now, I want to get to, you know, the disciples' response here in a moment, but I can imagine a psychologist kind of sitting there in the background saying, "I think this guy has anger management problems. We need to put him into an anger management class." But the disciples saw and heard something different. They heard the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy from Psalm chapter 69. And they saw the zeal of the Lord consuming his Messiah. The zeal of God. What is spiritual zeal? What does it look like? J.C. Ryle voiced the classic definition of spiritual zeal. He says, a zealous man in religion is preeminently a man of one thing. It is not enough to say he is earnest, hearty, uncompromising, thoroughgoing, wholehearted, even fervent in spirit. He sees one thing. He cares for one thing. He lives for one thing. He is swallowed up in one thing, and that one thing is to please God. Whether he lives or whether he dies, whether he has health or whether he has sickness, whether he is rich or whether he is poor, whether he pleases man or whether he gives offense, whether he is thought wise or whether he is thought foolish, whether he gets blame or whether he gets praise, whether he gets honor or whether he gets shame, for all this, the zealous man cares nothing. He burns for one thing, and that one thing is to please God and to advance God's glory. That's what the disciples saw on display when Jesus ransacked the temple, according to John, at the start of his ministry. Zeal for the Lord's house will consume me, Psalm 69 said. I remember years ago, first church that we served, when I was shortly out of seminary, a man came up to me after the morning worship service, and I had never seen him before. I think he was a first-time guest. I said, hello, what's your name? Put out his hand. He says, I'm a zealot for God. And your name, sir? I'm a zealot for God. Thought he was a little odd, wasn't quite sure. You know, he probably was a little odd for God, but over time I began to appreciate his zealousness. I don't meet very many people today who are willing to call themselves a zealot for God, or, you know, risk being a little too, you know, Jesus on my sleeves kind of thing. We dial it back, don't we? Jesus was never afraid to do that. The zeal of the Lord consumed him. And on that day, he exposed two problems plaguing the temple worship: commercialism and prayerlessness. And one might have led to the other. It appears that a profit motive had crept into the business activities of the temple. And prayer, the primary activity, got pushed to the periphery. I've been thinking about this a little bit. What was going on here in the scene? And my guess is that all the buying and selling going on in the temple began with some good intentions. People were traveling long distances to come to the Jewish festivals in Jerusalem. And, you know, if you were a young family with kids and all that, it was a pretty long slog, and you climb and ascend the mountain in which Jerusalem is. And you got to bring your animals along because you're going to the temple, and, you know, you enter the temple with the idea of giving a sacrifice to the Lord. Somebody came up with the idea, hey, why don't we provide some animals, you know, for that people can buy at the temple. And make it a little bit easier for the families here, and they don't have to bring their children and their animals. And so they began selling the animals at the temple. And it started off as a convenience and probably a good thing. But in time, somebody said, hey, we can make a profit at this, a pretty nice profit. And the price rose, and the whole thing became a business and not a ministry. And then you have the money changers. People were coming from different regions. There were different currencies, and they had to exchange their currency for the temple currency. And again, it started out as a ministry, but eventually they sold the franchise to a Ticketmaster, I guess, and there's this exorbitant convenience fee attached to entering the temple. Somebody had figured out a way to make some money. By the way, back then it was Annas, the high priest, whose son or son-in-law, I forget, was Caiaphas at the time that Jesus was crucified. Remember when they arrested Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, they took him first to Annas' house. Why Annas' house? He had the franchise on the buying and selling of animals and the money changing and all that. And if we're correct that there are two times that Jesus cleansed the temple, Annas had remembered this rabbi from Nazareth who came and upset his prophet and took a shot at the bottom line of his franchise. And so when they arrested him, he said, bring him to me first. I want a piece of him. They took him to Annas first, then to Caiaphas. It was a family business, this money changing and selling of sacrificial animals at the temple. Profiteering had crept into the temple and produced a leanness of soul that eventually led to prayerlessness. Jesus saw it at the beginning of his ministry. He carried that burden all the way to the end of his ministry. And the zeal of the Lord consumed him. And he said, this has to stop. If ministry is about making money, there's no time or motivation to pray. Yeah. It's a lot to digest at the front end of a series of messages about the Lord's Prayer. I don't want this series over the next several weeks to become an intellectual exercise for us. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, you know. And we begin to recite it. We're going to dive deeply into every phrase in this prayer that Jesus taught his disciples. But we have to begin with passion, a passion for prayer. It's time we return the house of God to its primary purpose, to be a place where people from all nations, from all segments of our community and our neighborhoods and our society, where all ethnicities can come to worship God and to pray. What would it take for you to pray with fervency and earnestness? What would it take for you to get to the point and for me to get to the point where I said, listen, prayer is as essential as the next breath I take? Would it take an NFL player collapsing on a football field and ending up in cardiac arrest to rivet your attention and bring your heart to a place of desperate prayer? Maybe it would. Maybe some other tragedy. But before we learn how to pray the Jesus way by revisiting this prayer that Jesus taught his disciples, let's make sure we have an unquenchable passion to pray. And then we give it its rightful place, a priority in our ministry. Apart from prayer, folks, we do nothing. We do nothing. We set ourselves up for failure, or at best for a short fly ball into center field rather than, you know, that home run in the bottom of the ninth with the bases loaded to win the World Series. We set ourselves up for something either or, depending upon the priority of prayer in our lives. Sometimes it takes a tragedy for us to return to belief in the power of prayer. But if some of that is lacking, that passion is lacking in any of us, including your pastor, let's take some time before we get into the prayer itself to beg God to fill us with the kind of fervency and passion that is in keeping with his agenda, not ours. He's going to teach us to pray, not my will, but thy will. He's going to teach us to pray, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Well, we're going to discuss all of that. But his agenda and his passion must fill our hearts first. And then I think we'll learn, as the disciples did, something about how to pray the Jesus way.